From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're following the news out of the White House today that the Trump administration has brokered a peace deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates.
We're also following other political news, including Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and his new running mate Kamala Harris will get a briefing today from public health officials on the COVID-19 outbreak. And this comes a day after their first appearance together, where they blamed President Trump for the severity of the crisis. On the Fox Business Network this morning, Trump shot back saying that the pandemic, quote, will be going away and the economy is on the upswing. President Trump also attacked Harris for aggressively questioning his Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh 2 years ago and played into a trope about black women.
And now you have a sort of a mad woman, I call her, because she was so angry and such hatred with Justice Kavanaugh.
Let's talk more about this with Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent. And Tam, your thoughts on that comment by the president? Is it fair to say he's struggling with how to define Harris?
Well, the campaign and the president are trying all kinds of different things. It's like the old spaghetti meatball, throw it up, see what sticks. They are trying various attacks, including President Trump calling her nasty, saying she was nasty to Brett Kavanaugh. He also seems really perplexed as to why Biden would pick Harris after Harris went after Biden in one of those early Democratic presidential debates. President Trump is somebody who prizes loyalty above all else, and it doesn't seem to be able to compute why this choice would be made. Another line he's taking is to say that she's a loser. She didn't even make it out of the primary. His campaign is also saying, you know, she didn't even make it to the caucuses. At the same time that they're saying that all of these things about her, they're also trying to do this thing where they're saying that Biden is a Trojan horse, or, this is really, you know, Democrats and liberals, and Harris is super liberal. And yes, you know, mm-hmm. Joe Biden is a moderate, but look at this. Look over here. Look at Harris saying that she's his new handler. It's a lot. It's all over the place. Yeah. It's not clear whether any of it will stick, because they've really struggled to get the public to turn away from Biden in any marked way.
Well, supporters have praised Harris's speech for laying out a vision and a sense of teamwork between she and Biden. Here she is yesterday blaming Trump for the state the country is in right now.
We're reeling from the worst public health crisis in a century. The president's mismanagement of the pandemic has plunged us into the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
But, you know, one thought about this, one counter thought is that wouldn't the economy be in the state we're in now under any president because of the coronavirus?
Well, that's a good question. And absolutely, there would be economic damage. I mean, this is a global pandemic and it is not good. However, there are different ways to respond to it, as you've seen around the world. Other countries have responded in ways that have allowed their economies to get back to safely return to a level of production that is better than what has happened in the United States. The way it has been handled in the United States, the way the outbreak has progressed, means that there are still millions of Americans without jobs, and schools mm-hmm. aren't able to open, and there are any number of other things that the Democrats would point to as, you know, like they would argue it doesn't have to be this way.
You know, there were lots of things that Biden and Harris also talked about yesterday. But in thinking about the staging, a lot of folks who watched the event yesterday say that it was awkward staging. Biden and Harris were speaking as if they were addressing a stadium full of supporters, but they were actually in a gym with reporters and no members of the public.
Yeah.
You chuckle at that, Tam, but how do you think that read, if in any way?
I mean, welcome to the pandemic. Like, you know, yeah. Nothing is normal. And absolutely, it was awkward. You know, like the picture, the classic picture of the new running mate and their spouse and the candidate and their spouse standing next to each other waving. Well, they were standing like 15 feet apart. And so like the picture is just another image of this pandemic. And absolutely, there was no cheering. Like, there were some people suggesting maybe they should get the crowd that the NBA has, the virtual crowd. Meanwhile, right. President Trump is able to hold events at his club and have people cheer
before
there.
I have 30 seconds with you, so I just have to ask you about Trump's explaining on Fox News that he doesn't want the post office to get any money in a congressional economic relief. Can you say more about that? How is that resonating today?
President Trump is really against vote by mail, and he has been fairly explicit about it. But this was the most explicit yet, essentially saying the quiet part out loud that he doesn't want to fund the post office because he doesn't want universal vote by mail.
That's Tamara Keith. Yes. Yeah. Tamara, we've got to go. NPR's Tamara Keith. Thank you.
And let's turn now to Iowa, where farmers are just beginning to assess the damage from a powerful derecho. This is like a tornado, but with flat gusts of wind rather than a spiral that flattened 10 million acres of corn and soybean this week, about a third of Iowa's cropland, before sweeping across the Midwest. Megan Anderson is a field agronomist, one of 11 across the state. As part of her job, she was at Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, teaching on a farm just west of Ames, Iowa, when this happened. And Megan, we understand this was a class of sophomores. You start to see the sky dark, and what happened?
Yeah, we were actually outside underneath some tents discussing weed identification and doing some hands-on activities when the sky started to get dark. And I think kind of being Iowans, we said, oh, well, you know, we're going to stick it out until we're forced to go inside. So we saw a bolt of lightning and ended up in the building there taking cover for quite a while. And the winds picked up really quickly. And I was able to actually see we have these large tents that are staked down and they're essentially permanent during the growing season. And one of them was flipped up and kind of thrown across the ground and ended up in a crumpled pile, and just constant howling winds. Everything just seemed to be blowing straight across the ground. The corn looked like it was lying flat. It was unlike anything I've ever seen.
Well, we're seeing pictures of huge, huge silos that are collapsed. And here, you know, this derecho was clocked blowing winds of up to 106 miles an hour. Does that mean all that corn is lost? And what about the soybean crop? What do you think is the extent of the damage?
So I think soybeans are easier to talk about because they leaned over pretty good on Monday. But most of the soybeans that I have seen seem to have mostly uprighted themselves. And the way that farmers harvest those, I'm hopeful that they're not really going to have any issues as we kind of approach harvest season here. Corn is a totally different story. Corn is going to be just exceedingly difficult to harvest, and it's very likely that we're going to have reduced yields because, you know, the leaves are laying on top of each other and the corn is on the ground, and in some cases part of its root system has been pulled out of the ground. They've been root lodged. So that's going to be bad, and then harvest losses are just going to be huge because in a number of these fields it will be very difficult for farmers to even pick up the corn to get it in the combine and out of the field.
Well, it's been a tough season anyway. The drought, trade war, plunging demand for ethanol. People are traveling less because of the pandemic. A derecho. Some of it should be covered under crop insurance, but how badly is this going to hurt people?
I think that the good news is that a lot of people do have crop insurance. I mean, that definitely is a bright side to it, but we're coming into just a really stressful period to begin with. And this is just one more thing on top of that. And it's going to be really hard.
Yeah. Do you get the sense, I mean, forecasters were surprised by this derecho. It came out of nowhere. It's impossible to say why. But how has climate been impacting farmers there? Can you see change?
I mean, yeah, I think that I can definitely see change. You know, we're more often, it seems like, experiencing these very dry Julys, and then typically we do start to get moisture again in August. And the past several years, we've had, I would say, more rain in the spring and more rain in the fall, making both planting and harvest very difficult. So I think we're definitely noticing more struggles, I guess I would say, with the weather here.
Yeah. And just briefly, what do you say to those sophomores that you happen to be working with who maybe are thinking of this as a career, farming? And I'm sure for many, this is their first derecho. They're not common.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were probably just excited that they got out of class at the time, unfortunately. But I think it goes to show the need that we have for farmers and for advisors for farmers and anybody who's getting into a career in agriculture, because we deal with all kinds of crazy things like derechos now. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that we support our farmers and that we're there to help them. And I think they know full well that it's not going to be an easy road. But they're not picking farming because it was the easy career choice.
Megan Anderson, an agronomist in Iowa, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jazz singer Candace Hoyes is often described as a musician come activist, her music a celebration of Black womanhood. Her latest work, Zora's Moon, is out this week, and it's her response to this moment of racial reckoning and what she calls an ode to Black girlhood. Candace Hoyes, singer, producer, and songwriter, joins us now as part of our series on how artists are reimagining and reflecting the current moment in their work. Candace, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tanya.
I want to start with your new single, Zora's Moon, which is an ode to Black girlhood through the life of Zora Neale Hurston. Share with us what Hurston means to you.
I feel like Zora Neale Hurston has had a connection to me since the first day I turned the page of Their Eyes Were Watching God when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And I was immediately connecting with so much of the issues she was referencing, colorism and sexism, the negotiation of what's respectable behavior, all those things that a Black teenage girl is defining for herself. And it was when I got to Harvard as an undergraduate that I got to read Hurston in a sister circle.
And can you explain what a sister circle is for folks just who may not know what you're saying when you refer to that?
I take a pleasure in that, because when I was 16, I had not contemplated the sister circle. And a sister circle refers to something that's it's a circle of female empowerment, of affirmation, where you can look to be felt and heard when you speak and when you explore new ideas. It's an expansive intellectual and spiritual space. And I took my first Black women's history course taught by Professor Higginbotham, Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham. And there I found scholars who wanted to be doctors and poets and activists, and probably someone wanted to be president, because that's how Harvard
is. It's Harvard,
is.
Yes.
And
yeah.
That's Harvard. So it was very powerful for me to be able to take those risks. And I feel like it really shaped the artist I am now. And I carry her forward, you know, I carry her forward.
There's a sample in the song that is actually from a 1943 radio interview with Zora Neale Hurston. Let's take a listen.
There was one thing you said about children that I love. Isn't it true that when we're little, we just think the world revolves around us?
Yeah.
Things are going to happen to other people, bad things. They aren't going to happen to us. No, sir. And that thing you said about the moon.
Well, if you go outdoors tonight and the moon is up, you get the first state the moon is in right now. But anyhow, if the moon is shining, you go out and you run and it'll follow you.
I smiled at this idea that children think the moon follows them. And this idea really resonates with you. Why do you think this message coming from Zora is so important in this moment?
That sample gives me goosebumps to this day, because I feel everything she writes, I feel, relates to that childhood experience. And then as she starts to write, and as I started to get to know her, she connects that to Black citizenship and a sense of identity. And I loved that in 1943, she was talking with this host, Mary Margaret McBride, who was herself a pioneer as a woman in radio, a queer woman. And these two women are having this interracial conversation in 43 about their girlhood. And then inside of that framing was the part that just sets my soul on fire when Zora starts to talk about the moon following her as a child. I always thought the moon was following me. And for me, as I connect with Zora, you know, the moon goes through phases, but the moon itself never changes. And the moon and the story about the moon becomes a portal for me into the next work I want to make. It becomes an affirmation, and it closes a certain sister circle between myself and Hurston.
So you say it's a portal into the next phase of your creativity and who you are as a person. Something that really strikes me about your work is how you draw from history in your music, of course, with Zora Neale Hurston. But in some ways, you are really something of an archivist in that you draw inspiration from the past and translate it to the present with your music. Who are your inspirations, and why do you think it's important, so important, to draw from the past?
Oh, I'm greatly influenced by Toni Morrison. I'm greatly influenced by Roberta Flack, Minnie Riperton, Billie Holiday, Sarah Vaughan, Leontine Price. Oh, I have many influences.
So many.
Across the disciplines. Yes, I think that the value of being an archivist and providing historic insight in my work, it expands a space that I think is needed, the sort of necessary growth of the canon to embrace my community, Black community, that have a history of being obscured, of being marginalized. I see myself along a sort of magical journey with this work.
It's definitely apparent in your music. I want to play your song Tired, which is your musical reimagining of Langston Hughes's poem. Let's listen.
I am so tired,
so tired
of waiting for the world to be good, beautiful, and kind.
He writes and you sing, I am so tired, aren't you, of waiting for the world to become good, beautiful, and kind. And you interpreted this with a deep groove and in this moving tempo. It sounds very futuristic.
Yes. I think that my songs are not only layered and sort of drenched in my own childhood sense of self, but I'm also very interested in engaging with girls today. And so I think having a sense of, you know, a futuristic tone is a part of my work. I also would say the futuristic sound also relates to why I love archives, because unlike my predecessors, this generation has the benefit of digital histories. In Zora's Moon, that interview that influenced me so much, and to be able to take a poem from the 30s and situate it in a context that feels like, you know, much more like my lifetime. I've actually sung Langston Hughes' poems set by classical composers in the lyrical style, and I've performed that, and I always felt that the Langston that I know would sound different today, and it really made me kind of pick up my pen and write what I felt my people would want to, you know, play at the barbecue, play around the table, play in the basement, play in your car. Those are the spaces where I want to bring this powerful poetry too. It's an affirmation, it's a encouragement, it's a way to fortify people in this difficult time.
Speaking of this moment that we're in, that many people are calling a racial reckoning, where does your music, your art, come into play in all of this? And what really is activism?
I would say we are in a period of racial reckoning. It doesn't mean that the solutions and the structural remedies are very expedient or that they are easy to understand. It's going to take extended conversation. It's going to take extended engagement. And so I think that my life in activism and archival history is going to really come to bear now, because it's not something that is a new impression for me. This is something I've thought about a long time. In that way, I think that being an artist has always helped me to focus on my voice, no matter how many people may not agree at a table or a room. There's a certain inner sense of self that I return to, and that's what, you know, emboldens me to do something that I feel is necessary as an artist. And then I think that that is the same place in me that my sense of activism, you know, links up to. And so I've always believed that in the power of my own voice. But I also believe that if I have that gift, that I would like to foster that among other people. And so whether it's a circle or a community or a classroom, whatever community I'm in.
That's Candace Hoyes, singer, songwriter, and producer. And we will link Candace's music, including Zora's Moon, at hereandnow.org. And we have a special treat. Let's go out to listening to a special sneak peek of Candace's song, Pink Clouds.
Do you know the clouds are pink on Mars? At sunrise, fuchsia, my love. In the coldest place they've ever known, there are pink clouds.
Candace, thank you so much.
This was great.
Thank you. Such a pleasure.
Make a way. And the sunset stretches purple blue. When I'm with you.
President Trump is calling a peace deal his administration has brokered between Israel and the United Arab Emirates historic. Others see it differently. For more, let's bring in NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. And Michelle, the deal between Israel and the UAE, a wealthy sovereign state the Israelis have worked with informally before, not Israel and the Palestinians. But what does this deal allow?
Well, it allows for these two countries to normalize diplomatic relations and become above board with it. As you said, you know, they've worked privately for many years together, mostly on counterterrorism. But this is going to be out in the open, which is important for Israel symbolically. Trump says they're going to be signing a series of agreements on trade, tourism, and on opening embassies. And the Emiratis say there's something in it for Arab countries, too, that this should put a stop to Israel's controversial plans to annex parts of the West Bank.
Mm. So what are Palestinians saying about this?
Well, you know, of course, they want the West Bank as their part of their future state, right? So Hanan Ashrawi, a senior Palestinian official, took to Twitter today to complain that Israel's getting rewarded for not declaring openly what it has been doing to Palestine, that is, building on land that the Palestinians hope will be part of their future state. She's also suggesting that the Emiratis are selling out the Palestinians with this deal, and you're hearing complaints from other Palestinians about that as well.
Okay. Well, the deal does benefit Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu and President Trump, because they're both arguably at maybe their weakest politically. And President Trump was asked in his press conference or his presentation of this deal, why now? What did he say?
Well, he's making a big deal out of it. Secretary of State Pompeo said that it's been in the works for some time. They've been talking about this. And remember, this whole issue of annexation kind of came to a head this summer. Netanyahu was promising to take this step to declare sovereignty over Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And this sort of gives him a way out of that. You know, the Arab world was furious with this. The Emiratis in particular were furious with this. And it was going to be a huge problem politically. And Netanyahu has to think about who comes next in the White House. If President Trump loses to Joe Biden, that could be an issue for him going ahead. And then otherwise, you know, this gives Trump some some good news to tout. His vision for the Middle East, the project that his son-in-law led, has really gone nowhere since it was announced earlier this year.
Well, in fact, is the idea of a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians still alive at all in the Middle East?
That's hard to say. It doesn't look like it. I mean, if they don't follow through with annexation, possibly, we'll see. I should point out that during that big White House ceremony earlier this year when they announced the vision, the United Arab Emirates ambassador was the only Arab official at the White House. So it's no surprise here that the UAE is the one Arab country that's taking this step today.
Okay, President Trump announcing a deal brokered by his White House between the Israelis and the Emiratis, the United Arab Emirates. We will be hearing more about this, I'm sure, from Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent, over the course of the day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Every day we report on COVID-19 cases and deaths across the country. But do these numbers really give a true view of how widespread this virus is? California recently reported massive errors, as many as 300,000 test results never put into a database. Officials now say that glitch is fixed. But it still points to problems in how we're tracking the virus. Dr. Tom Frieden is former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. His nonprofit group is Resolved to Save Lives. And Dr. Frieden is on Skype. Welcome.
Great to speak with you, Tanya.
Yes, so Dr. Frieden, the New York Times reports today that across the country, 200,000 more people have died than normal. That's since March. If these people have indeed died from COVID-19-related illnesses, we still are not certain of that. That would actually mean that 60,000 more people have died than official statistics tell us. Do you think we're underestimating the death toll from COVID? And what risk does an underestimation of cases and deaths mean in our efforts to contain this virus?
Well, first, to put this into context, reported COVID deaths are already the third leading cause of death in the United States for 2020. They follow only heart disease and cancer as causes of death. In terms of the total numbers of deaths, this is something we look at with a term called excess mortality. And excess mortality consists of three different groups. One, reported COVID deaths. The second, people who died from COVID, but whose diagnosis was not made or reported. And the third group are people who died because of COVID, but not because of the infection, but rather because of the disruption that COVID caused in healthcare, particularly heart attacks.
Are you concerned, though, about these data glitches in particular and what that could mean for what we know regarding the number? Does that change our view of risk overall?
Well, on the one hand, I agree with the analysis that there are undoubtedly more deaths from COVID and also deaths associated with COVID than have been reported. The broader issue for me is that we need to do much better in understanding our risk, our response, and the enemy. The enemy here is the virus, and that enemy, the virus, really preys on any fault lines in society, whether those fault lines are partisan politics or suspicion of government, or meatpacking factories, or the way we care for our elderly in nursing homes, or racial injustice. And where there are fault lines, the virus spreads. One way we can get ahead of it is to get much better information. And that's why our group, Resolve to Save Lives, has advocated for 15 essential indicators, measures of where the virus is and how we're doing to attack it, that should be reported at least weekly from every state and every county. But without that kind of information, we risk getting further and further behind.
Do you see us moving in that direction based on the work that you're doing with your organization?
I see lots of signs of progress and hope. I see public health and healthcare professionals working really hard around the country, but we're still a long way from where we need to be. If we just take two of the essential components of a response, rapid testing and rapid isolation, we're flying blind. Right now, hundreds of thousands of laboratory tests every day are being done with turnaround times of 5, 7, 10, 14 days. That's a colossal waste of money. And when it comes to isolation and warning contacts, there are only a few places around the country reporting how they're doing with that. And mostly, we need to do a lot better. Our organization works in nearly 100 countries around the world, and the U.S., frankly, is a laggard. We see countries like Senegal, Uganda, Ethiopia, not to mention Iceland, Singapore, Hong Kong, and elsewhere, reporting and acting on this essential information so they can keep COVID down. Broadly speaking, there are two things we have to do. The first is to increase distance and safety, and that includes the three W's: wear a mask correctly, wash your hands, and watch your distance. It includes closures of bars and indoor dining when COVID is spreading widely. And on the other hand, we need to do better boxing the virus in with quick strategic testing, rapid and effective isolation, complete contact tracing, and supportive quarantine. That's how we keep cases from becoming clusters and clusters from spreading widely and forcing us to shut down again.
So with that protocol, masks and distance, I mean, this week and next week and the next few weeks, really, schools are reopening and some schools are reopening in person. We know today we've learned that more than 2,000 students and teachers and staff across 5 states have had to quarantine now that they've met in person. That's according to CNN. What is your reaction to what you're seeing there? You mentioned bars as a place of spread, but should districts planning to reopen for in-person learning, like New York City, for instance, be pivoting now?
Any community can open schools, but only a community that does two things right can keep them open safely. The first is to control COVID in the community. If COVID is spreading widely, there is no way the school can open safely. It's going to have to shut again. And so the first thing a community has to do is to control COVID. The second is to adapt in the schools. And there's lots that needs to be done to reduce risk, to protect the most vulnerable, and to prepare for the inevitability that there will be cases and exposures, and how to limit that so it minimizes the harm. But it's absolutely the case that there are also big harms to keeping kids out of school. Distance learning isn't working for all. It's not equivalent, particularly for younger kids, particularly for kids who don't have easy access to broadband or informatics. It is actually leading to even larger educational disparities than already existed. So we all agree we want the kids back in school learning, but that can only be done if we all work together, stay apart, get COVID down in our community, and adapt our schools to the new reality of COVID.
Elsewhere in the program, we're talking to Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's a leading infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota. And he says we need a 6-week shutdown right now to save lives and the economy. Do you agree with this idea?
I don't. I think we need to be much more granular in how we take action. And if you look at the shutdown over the spring, it was too soon, too long in too many places. And because of that, you have enormous resentment from people, quite understandably, who had to curtail a lot of their activities when there was virtually no or no COVID in their community. What makes much more sense is to get eyes on the virus, to figure out where it's spreading, and then to take action in those places to keep it down. That kind of targeted approach is going to be much more effective and sustainable, and I think much more acceptable for people to adhere to.
But doctor, part of the criticism that many people have about the response to COVID-19 is that there is no federal guideline. And so every state, every city, every municipality is doing something different based on what they're experiencing. But it has caused havoc in a way that no one really has a clear message on how to mitigate what we're seeing. How would you advise federal intervention, if at all, as part of this? You've mentioned how you'd like to see states take on this problem.
We absolutely need a much more organized federal response. It's really stunning that more than 6 months into this pandemic, we have no clear plan, no clear national communications, no clear line of command. I hope the federal government will do those things. Short of that, at least we should get the kind of information that we all deserve about what's going on in our state and in our community. And with that, we can take more specific action to tamp down the virus and keep it down. There's no one solution to this virus, not masks, not staying home, not testing, not contact tracing, and not treatment, not even a vaccine. We need to chip away at the risk. We need to do all of those things and more, and we need to continuously learn how and where the virus is spreading so we can reduce the risk and how we can most effectively support individuals, communities, and protect our healthcare workers and healthcare system.
That's Dr. Tom Frieden. He's a former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Frieden, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you're a hockey fan, you had to stay up late the other night if you wanted to see the end of the Stanley Cup playoff game between the Columbus Blue Jackets and the Tampa Bay Lightning. Tied at 2 goals apiece after 60 minutes of regulation, the game went into overtime. 5 overtimes, to be exact. It finally ended more than 6 hours after it started when Tampa Bay scored to win 3-2. Oh, if only anyone was there. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, what a shame. I mean, no banging on the plexiglass, no throwing of things on the ice. Nobody there.
Well, I guess some octopi were saved, although that's a Red Wing tradition, thrown on the ice. Yeah, when a game goes, as you know, more than 3 overtime periods, it really is 2 games since overtime periods in the playoffs are regulation. So they played 2.5 games. And what was amazing is that the goalie for the Columbus Blue Jackets, 83 saves. I mean, this is a week's work. This is a week and a half's work. You can't even, I can't even fathom that many saves. And then to lose the game based on that, it was such a long game that the, you know, since they're bubbling and all the teams play in one of two arenas spread throughout Canada, the next game had to be postponed because, of course, we already played 2 games right beforehand.
Well, can't they figure out a way to do this without so many overtimes or no? Is that just locked in?
I think that I do like in baseball that they have a new rule with a player on second base to speed things along. But I think overtime playoff hockey goes well together. The stakes are high. No one is just wanting to get out of there. I think it is a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. Oh, so the NHL, the NBA, and WNBA all in bubbles. But the Kentucky Derby may run with a few thousand fans. Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones says he expects his team will play this year with fans in the stands. And then you've got former Notre Dame coach Lou Holtz, who compared college football to one of the most selfless moments of World War II, saying when they stormed Normandy, they knew there were going to be casualties. They knew there were going to be risks, as if, you know, you're saying to college students, hey, you know, be like those troops and take this risk. Are we going to see sporting events this calendar year? Big ones like that?
Yeah, not an overwrought analogy at all. And of course, the soldiers who stormed Normandy were paid, unlike college football players. I think, well, we are already seeing some sports with fans. They played a couple MLS games and scattered throughout the stadium were a couple thousand fans. I don't know. Jerry Jones is going to bluster and be a showman. So maybe his statements were an indication of hope over experience, over how Texas is experiencing the pandemic. We might see some fans scattered throughout, but I don't think that that would or should be the priority.
Yeah, but college football, there's supposed to be 2 major conferences later this month, the Big Ten and the Pac-12, but they're canceled. College football has almost more of an emotional tie to some people. Do you think the other big college football conferences will play?
Right now, there's a regional split. So Pac-12, as the name would indicate, is on the West Coast, and the Big Ten is a Midwestern conference. And the Big East, which is a smaller conference, they've canceled too. So those are the places where the states in general have had spread and containment, and to a large degree, they're managing their containment. When we talk about the SEC or the Big 12, these are southern conferences, and so the spread of the disease has progressed differently. But also the politics there are different, and I dare say that the I'm not going to insult a Michigan or Ohio State fan, but in SEC country in the Southeast, football is a little bit more important than sports. So I guess they are going to try to hang on, but as has frequently been shown, the virus does not care about regional loyalties, does not care about the coaches' poll or the AP poll. The virus is the virus, and if players start coming down with it, and some are, I don't see how these conferences can say, we're going to go ahead when we're putting our players at risk who aren't paid. And also, we are part of a college community, and we're going to have, what, totally different rules for our student-athletes. They're very proud to call them student-athletes. They're going to live in a different set of circumstances than the rest of the students. That will be hard to do emotionally. That will be a hard argument to make. I think it's definitely clear they want to do this. I don't know if they can.
Yeah, okay, real quick. The president was on Fox Sports Radio this week. He was asked about the NFL. I'll synopsize. He says they want to open badly. They've been working with the government. But if they don't stand for the national anthem, I hope they don't open. He was on for more than 20 minutes. He seemed especially upset with the NBA. What did he say?
Yeah, he was on the Clay Travis show, and he knows that, or he tries to make hay with picking a fight on these cultural issues of standing for the anthem. And he said he didn't care for that. He also called for college football to play again and made some medically irresponsible statements about how the virus doesn't affect strong, healthy players. There are many instances of no college players dying from it, but apparently getting a very serious sickness, and including heart diseases. And this isn't a college player, but, you know, Red Sox pitcher Eduardo Rodriguez. I mean, his life's going to be affected by the heart ailments that he got in conjunction with coronavirus. So
the
Clay Travis, a friendly forum for Donald Trump to say essentially what he has been saying about the virus, and it isn't always accurate.
Okay. Mike Pesca, thanks so much. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.